Welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast series by Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I'm Giuseppe Porcaro, and today we are going to discuss views from USA and Europe around the principles and challenges of social protection systems in light of various non-standard forms of work and the many shocks we face, including the recession, the pandemic, and the high inflation. This episode is produced with the Transatlantic Expert Group on the Future of Work, which is an interdisciplinary group of some 30 knowledgeable and highly qualified experts. And it explores the multiple emerging challenges in the area of the future of work by bringing together their respective perspectives from the European Union and the United States. The TEG has been brought together by Bruegel and the German Marshall Fund of the United States with the financial support of the European Union. I'm happy to welcome today Kathleen Roeming, Director of Social Security and Disability Policy at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities in Washington. And she works on Social Security, Supplemental Security Income, paid leave, and other budget issues. Hi, Kathleen. How are you?
Hello. Wonderful. Thank you for having me.
And I'm also having the pleasure of welcoming Anke Hassel, who is Professor of Public Policy at the Hertie School in Berlin, with an extensive international experience and scientific expertise in the fields of the labor market, social partnership, co-determination, and the comparative political economy of the developed industrial nations. Anke, welcome to The Sound of Economics.
Hello, Giuseppe. Thank you for having me.
Going into the topic, the core topic that we want to discuss today, social protection is the mechanism that addresses, amongst other issues, poverty reduction, education, health, social inclusion, and empowerment. In the United States and in Europe, social protections were initially designed between the end of the 19th century and the mid of the 20th century, with the full-time dependent employee in mind. Today, the standard employment relationship remains a critical but not the only mechanism through which the social protections are provided to the employee by the employer and or through the contributions made by both the employer and the employee into the national social insurance funds designed to manage the risk of unemployment, ill health, and disability and retirement. The challenge that confronts the United States and Europe is that in the context of a changing labor market and the increase in non-standard work, the classical mechanism through which social protections were provided is diminishing. In this conversation, we want to explore this challenge in particular. But before doing so, let's have a step back and let's summarize for our listeners the differences and similarities on social protection systems in the US and EU. Kathleen, can you help to start this navigation and tell us the situation on the other side of the Atlantic?
Sure. Well, in the United States, the system of social protection is very complicated. One reason is that what level of protection, whether you qualify for that protection, depends on where you live. So some of our major programs, like Social Security, our system of old age and disability pensions, are federal programs, and the eligibility and benefit levels are the same throughout the country. Others, like Medicaid, which provides health insurance for low-income people, many millions and millions of low-income people, it varies dramatically by state. It's a federal state program, but eligibility and coverage and waiting lists vary a lot by state. And then there are others that are completely state-dependent, like paid leave, including parental leave for when mothers and fathers have new babies, is only available in certain states that have adopted that program. So that's one of the ways that the US system really varies a lot depending on where you live. Another issue in the United States is that no program is totally universal, not even the old age pensions, which are based on work. So many benefits are only available to workers or to people who are unable to work because they're children, elderly, or very severely disabled. So that's an important part of our system, that many benefits are only available to workers. And many benefits are also delivered through our tax system, and not every person in the United States has a tax liability. And so that leaves out many of the lowest income people in the United States. And of course, you know, since we're talking about non-traditional work, the definition of worker and which workers pay taxes and which taxes they pay really means that a lot of those non-traditional workers are left out of government benefits.
We are going to get back on non-traditional forms of work because this is going to be one of the core issues we want to debate over there. But let's travel back to the EU and ask Anke how things are over here, because we also have a patchwork of systems. I mean, we have different member states which have different ways of dealing with social protections, but also some commonalities. Can you tell us more?
Yes, I can follow up on of Kathleen and by saying in Europe it is also very complicated, but it's complicated in a different way. In the European Union, the responsibility for social protection lies completely in the hands of the member states. There is no European Union level responsibility for that, with some exceptions when it comes to labor market regulation. Some areas like working time is regulated by the European level. But the most important areas when we talk about pensions, social assistance, but also health, it is all regulated at the level of member states. And the member states are very different. They're very different historically. They come from very different origins. We have very different systems in Eastern Europe compared to Western Europe. But we also have very different approaches towards social protection. So we have some countries where social protection is much more liberal and also much more limited. And we can see that when we look at, for instance, social spending, public social spending, as percentage of GDP, when we compare member states, we see that Ireland has about 13% of public spending on social issues, compared to France, where we have a level of 31%. So these are huge differences between member states in the way how governments see their role for social protection. And in addition to that, we also have very different mixes between private and public. We have very different pension systems. Some pension systems are completely funded. Some pension systems are completely in the public realm. And we all have countries where social assistance is very different to other countries. Some countries do not really have a social assistance system like Italy until recently, whereas in other countries it is fully fledged. And just a final word on how different European member countries are. We also have to bear in mind that the level of economic development in the EU is very different. So we have very different wage levels. If we look at wages in Denmark the average wage is around 40 euros, the hourly wage, compared to Bulgaria, where we talk about 6 euros. So it's almost 10 times the amount in Denmark compared to Bulgaria. So these all these things come together, which make it very difficult to define a European approach towards social protection. And the way that it has evolved over the last 30 years or so is that at the European level, there were increasingly social elements introduced into the European treaties, for instance, that we now have articles within the Treaty on the Functioning of the European Union that gives social rights to European citizens. We also have the European Social Charter by the Council of Europe. And we have most recently, we have the European Pillar of Social Rights, where again, at the European level, there are a number of rights given to people, and that is the right to fair remuneration, but also the right for a written work contract, the right to social protection, which are general rights, which are not defined. It doesn't explain at all how these rights are imposed into the social security systems, but the EU tries to make sure that these rights exist and that each is European citizen has some fundamental right to social protection.
So very different situation, but a couple of common challenges we've been outlining already. On one hand, the challenge of the diversity, this patchwork. I mean, even if we have a federal level in the United States, we still have 50 different systems, I mean, at state level. So that's a pretty comparable situation, I would say, from that point of view. And obviously, EU level, which is slowly trying to ensure that there is some common frames as well, as Anke mentioned. But the other thing which seems to emerge from already this first words that you've been saying is that new forms of work have been impacting on the two sides of the Atlantic on the way the social systems are being conceived and developed and further reformed. So how do you think these new forms of work, what you've been calling non-standard work, which basically encompasses various typologies from self-employed to gig economy, independent contractors, and you name it, you know, are changing the actual landscape of the labor market? Because I think this is an important point to understand before we can move on the policy level and see how the policy has been changing or should be changing. I don't know who would like to start in terms of ping pong between the two sides of the Atlantic. I'm looking at Kathleen, maybe.
Sure. Yeah, we've always had non-standard work in some forms, and it's always posed a challenge for programs of social protection. So, you know, things like family farms or domestic and agricultural workers have always been part of the American economy. And for Social Security, the program that I know the best, that has posed a huge challenge. It was very difficult to get domestic and agricultural workers into the system, for example. They are in now, but it took a long time. And it's one of the roots of the racial disparities in coverage in those programs. But the problem with non-standard work is really growing because we have a lot of different trends now. I mean, one is the rise of the gig economy, things like ride sharing and Airbnb and other things like that. So that's a bigger part of the economy. It really has not been encompassed into our programs of social protection in any meaningful way. And then there's the trend to change the way that people who were previously treated as employees are now treated, where they're treated as independent contractors or they're treated as temporary employees. And so they don't get the same benefits as ordinary employees. And so in the United States context, estimates vary as far as how many people are in non-standard employment, from 10 to 30%, depending on the survey or depending on the way that term is defined. So it's a large and growing share of the U.S. economy.
What about the EU?
The EU is pretty similar in the sense that the bulk of employment is standard employment. The bulk of employment is on regular contracts. And it might be part-time, but it is a dependent employment relationship. And that is still the foundation also of all social protection systems. Almost all social protection systems are based on employment. But as Kathleen said, you know, the share of non-standard employment is also on the rise within the EU, and it is on the rise, you could say, in a very similar way in the US, and maybe not to the same extent. And again, it is very difficult to find numbers on this because we talk about variations of non-standard work, and it matters whether you talk about fixed-term contracts or temporary agency work or solo self-employment, the independent contractors, or the gig economy. So depending on sort of how you lump them together as non-standard works, you come to a percentage which is probably around 20% or 25% of people who have a non-standard employment relationships. And not for all of them this is a problem, because we also have to recognize that for some people, non-standard work actually works quite well. And that, you know, when we talk about students, but also old age pensioners do not necessarily want to work in a standard employment relationship. So, and they are sort of fully protected because they have other means of income. But for a considerable share of people, they non-standard work is their main source of income, and they have much less social protection than other people. And that is a problem. And it is also a problem because this sort of coincides with the rise of new social risk. And if we look at the evolution of the welfare state, we know that the standard old social risk were the risk of old age or the risk of bad health or the risk of unemployment. And that is the major sort of social protection schemes are covering old social risk. But we have new social risk, and this is really new groups of citizens in societies that end up in much more precarious social situations. And these groups of citizens are foreigners, immigrants. A lot of migrants end up in employment, which is less well protected, and they end up in non-standard work. But we also find that if we look at the relationship between younger workers and older workers, and we know that the risk has shifted from about 50 years ago, it was the older workers who were at risk of poverty. We know that it is increasingly younger workers who are at risk of poverty, and it is single parents.
I wonder, Anke, I just wonder, because that's core issue to be understood. These new forms of social risks, do they mean that the ones that were traditionally considered as socially risky segments or cohort of workers are less in a risky situation? So is there a switch, or is there an overall increase of the workers that are in a situation of social risk, basically? Is this just a shift, or are we actually in a situation where we are worse off than before?
Well, it is a bit of both, and we can see the shift. We can definitely see the shift from older workers to younger workers. So when we talk about social risk, we talk about the risk of poverty. In the past, there was a much higher risk for older workers, and including pensioners, retired people, who had the risk of poverty. This risk of poverty for older people has declined, but at the same time, the risk of poverty for younger people, in particular young workers, has increased. So there we have a shift. But at the same time, when we talk about migrant communities, we also see that migrant communities are growing, because we have a much larger share of immigration now. But we also know that immigrants are much more likely to end up in non-standard work. And when they work in non-standard work, they are much less protected. So they run a much higher risk of poverty. And the third group, which I would call the affected by new social risk, are single parents, because single parents, you know, have grown in numbers also over the last decades. And they are much more likely to end up either not in work at all, or in work which is marginal part-time, or in another way non-standard, and they have a much higher risk of poverty.
And is that the case in the US as well, Kathleen?
Yeah, I would say the dynamics are very similar in the US, for sure. And I would add, as far as parents, I think we have to protect against new risks now that many more women have entered the labor force, both traditional and non-traditional, you know, in the US and elsewhere, because before we didn't need things like paid maternity leave or other things that are really important to maintain women's employment in the labor force. And so that's just another risk that wasn't as necessary before when we had a male-dominated labor force.
That's interesting, because parental leave has been quite a fix into social protection systems in Europe since the beginning. So it's very interesting difference that you are highlighting over there, that for the states is somehow a new need which is arising, or a new perceived need, while for us in Europe it was something of an acquis from before. But speaking of the fact that these new labor markets, which are much more flexible, somehow profit to the firms that are using those new forms of contract and so on. So what responsibilities do those firms have to cover the cost of protecting workers, despite the fact that they might not be in standard forms of employment with them?
I think one responsibility, especially here in the United States, is to classify workers accurately. That, you know, as I mentioned before, part of our problem here is that employees, people who were formerly considered employees, for example, a janitor or someone who works in the cafeteria, was an employee of, say, Ford Motor Company. And now often those people are treated as independent contractors and not as employees, and they don't have the same worker protections and government benefits that they would have if they were treated as employees. And so I think that treating, and much of the gig economy is that way too. Rideshare driver is in many ways an employee, but they're classified as self-employed. And I think if one responsibility of employers is to classify workers accurately and make sure that they get the protections that are associated with that classification. But we will still have some people who are working in truly non-traditional jobs, and we want to make sure that those employers do offer employer-based benefits, which are more important here in the United States. We get so many of our benefits through our employers, like notably healthcare is typically provided through the employer. Retirement savings are typically provided through the employer, you know, that they do provide more benefits for non-standard workers, and that they pay adequate taxes for the government benefits that all workers should be receiving.
Anke, is that similar to the States, the situation in the EU? Maybe the public sector, the public response is also more vigorous than the States, where maybe the accent is more about the responsibilities of the employer, or there is a change in the debate also on our side?
Again, that varies a lot between member states, and in particular, the classification of independent contractors varies a lot. And we see that when we look at the regulation of the gig economy and provisions for gig workers, that member states have found very different solutions, whether they force the tech companies to treat gig workers as employees or whether they let them hire them as independent contractors. So there are very different experiences. And there's also, which I find interesting, experiences that those countries where they insist that gig workers have to be treated as employees, this is not necessarily always in the interest of the workers. So, you know, there are also sort of pros and cons, because also workers lose some of the flexibility in that case. And in particular, sort of, and even in some countries like Italy, you have even a variation between that some of the gig workers are employed and some are independent contractors. And if you compare them, it's not necessarily always the best solution. So which shows, you know, it is a complicated problem, and there's no sort of standard answer on how to deal with that. But the overriding message is that companies do take advantage of more precarious work arrangements, and self-employment and having people as independent contractors obviously pushes the entire responsibility for social protection onto the individual, because they then have to look after themselves and make sure that they're insured in some way or that they get some pension fund going, and the cost lies exclusively with them. The answer to that, in a very general way, must be that companies who use a lot of independent contractors, solo self-employed people, must be asked to contribute to social security schemes for these workers. And then the question is, how can that look like? Can we have sort of independent, can we have a middle way that there is solo self-employment or independent contractors, but at the same time, those companies who really benefit from these workers, you know, how can they contribute? How can we make firms contribute to the social protection schemes for these workers?
Moving maybe to the broader constellation, because since we are speaking about new forms of works and we are speaking about things which are not exactly the same as they used to be, should we continue to base social protection on employment at all? Or shall we move to more non-work-based social benefits? You know, there is big talk about basic income, tax finance benefits for everyone, and so forth. What's the level of debate? Is there a debate in the US on that at the moment?
I think there's been some shift in the US. As I mentioned earlier, not only public benefits, but private benefits like employer-provided health insurance and employer retirement savings plans at work are a really important part of our benefit system. And those are only available if you have an employer and if your employer offers those things. And we've started to shift away from that a little bit, where the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare, did shift so that more workers were able to access health insurance on the private market with subsidies. And likewise with retirement savings, there are more opportunities now to save in state programs where you can get an automatic deduction into your retirement savings program. So there's been a slight shift in that direction away from private benefits offered by employers toward more public benefits. In terms of purely public benefits, in the United States, we've been historically very resistant to universal benefits. No benefits are truly universal here. They're almost always contingent on something, usually work or the inability to work. And there have been very few exceptions. One very notable recent exception was for 1 year during the pandemic, we offered a child tax credit, which was essentially a child allowance, to almost all families, including families with no earnings. That was a really big deal. It was a monthly benefit, except for the very highest earning families. Families got a check every month, regardless of whether they filed income taxes or owed income taxes. And so that was very important, but it only lasted a year. And advocates are pretty disillusioned with the fact that it doesn't seem to be coming back.
While in Europe, many member states are actually experimenting with some of those systems, right, Anke?
Yes, we have a number of member states that have set up experiments on some kind of universal basic income. But if we look at the motivation why these experiments have been set up, it is mainly to do with the complexity of social assistance schemes and the bureaucratic nature of them. Because in many of the EU member states, we now have welfare states that are highly developed, but also highly bureaucratic. And that has to do with sort of an idea of social protection that takes into account each individual case. And for each individual case, there are new rules and regulations, which makes the whole system very complex, but also very difficult to access. So if we look at these experiments, one of the reasons is, you know, how can we streamline social assistance schemes to make them easier for those people who have to administer them, but also for those people who have to access them. And UBI can be seen as one way to do that, because it's a sort of, in theory, a very sort of easy tool and a very easy way to think about things. And if we look at the Finnish case, and the Finnish case was all sort of to look at how do people behave if long-term unemployed have a sort of guaranteed income, and is this sort of propensity to look for work, is it at the same level compared to other schemes? So there is a sort of motivation to experiment with that, which is more to figure out sort of what are the disadvantages of current social assistance schemes and unemployment benefit schemes, and how can we find better tools. And I think it's much better to look at it that way, sort of to use the existing schemes and to think about how can we improve them, how can we address certain disadvantages or failures of the system, rather than to have a sort of much bigger debate on universal basic income, which is to say, you know, let's replace all existing social protection schemes and introduce just a negative income tax where people who do not have an income get a sort of guaranteed income by the state. So that is the trend in many European member states, to sort of look at the schemes as they are. How can we improve them? Are there elements of universal transfer payments which make the system easier to navigate and also easier to administer, rather than replacing the entire system?
Thank you. And we're going towards the end of these episodes, but what it seems to clear to me is that Europe and the United States are confronted at least with one challenge, which is common, which is to organize diverse forms of employment in a way that is suited to real economic conditions while ensuring adequate security for the workers in all forms of employment. But the real question on the table, let's put it a more philosophical question on the table to conclude, and I would like to ask to both of you your own personal view on it, is should social protection be a human right or not?
My own personal view is yes, it should be. There should be a right to things like housing and food and healthcare. That's not a view that's universally shared here in the United States. And that's been one of the major barriers to having universal social programs. There's a strong culture of only providing benefits to the so-called deserving, or only providing benefits with certain strings attached, for example, work requirements, which exist in many programs. And so that's one of the biggest hurdles that we have, is we don't have a culture that believes that social protection is a human right.
Thank you. Anke, what about Europe and you?
First of all, the entire debate within the sort of human rights discourse is to include many more economic and social rights as human rights. So that is the trend we're going in, you know, globally as well. But in the EU, this discussion has already progressed much further. And there is a Charter of Fundamental Rights of the European Union, which mentions the access to social protection as a fundamental right. And as I mentioned earlier, we have the European Social Charter, which is a treaty by the Council of Europe that guarantees fundamental social and economic rights already for those countries which are part of the Council of Europe. So this discussion in Europe has already happened. The question is really, how strong are these rights and what can we do with them? You know, what sort of entitlement do you get from them?
The implementation challenge. Absolutely. Unfortunately, this is all the time we have for these episodes, but I would like to thank Anke and Kathleen because this was a very interesting conversation, and we are going to keep this learning in between the two sides of the Atlantic alive with our series of podcasts and analysis dedicated to the Transatlantic Expert Group on the future of work, which you are both part of, obviously. So thank you so much. And I would like to remind our listeners that they will find in the show notes the link to the project page of the Transatlantic Expert Group on the Future Work. And as usual, they can read in open access all the analysis by our scholars on our website, www.bruegel.org. Thanks a lot for joining The Sound of Economics. Until next time, bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.